Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 98. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org. Editorial on Passion and Gadflies by Chisel. Listening to The Brilliant and to Bellamy's pleas for civil conversation and his regret that he erred in being too hostile in corrosive consciousness makes me think about Bob Black. To be clear, Bob Black is an asshole. He is misogynistic, delusional, alcoholic, and horrible. There is something to the absolute fact that he has fucked up his own life far more than he has done damage to anyone else, which does make me feel sorry for him, but doesn't change anything else. But Bob Black also played an important role in anarchist circles. In a time when anarchists were worker-focused, when red anarchy was the main story being told, he went against the grain as hard as he possibly could and wrote about how work itself is part of the problem. It takes a particular kind of personality to be willing to alienate so many people in order to point out a different vision. Frequently, those people are difficult. That is, they are willing to say things that people don't want to hear. They're willing to piss people off. They get more out of thinking they're right than having friends. Yes, one could say that Bob was the anarchist's anarchist. Then, connect that to the fact that Corrosive Consciousness is carefully, conscientiously written, with lots of evidence and backup and explication of the points that Bellamy makes about the most significant anarcho-primitivists in his life. If he had not been pissed off, would he have written such a thought-out book? Would he have stayed focused on it long enough to think it through so thoroughly? Maybe here I'm mixing two things that don't have to go together. One being the emotional commitment that comes from anger and frustration and that brings with it hostility, and the other the personality type that is prepared to burn bridges in order to say and or do something difficult. I don't know. They seem connected to me. And I definitely prefer to err on the side of trusting people to be able to hear difficult things and deal with them, than the other option of couching things so carefully that they are almost impossible to find among the fluff. Look at these prices. Look at the ice and the way I rock these jewels. Tell me nice. Tell me nice, I'll pull up and I'll come through. Tell me nice. Tell me nice, I'll pull up and I'll come through. Tell me nice. Tell me nice, I'll pull up and I'll come through. Niggas kick shot. What's new this week? Trial against Belgian anarchists set to begin on April 29th. From Act for Freedom Now. This is a fairly brief announcement of the Belgian state's investigation of and charges against anarchists and some anarchist projects. Quote, raids, bugs, cameras outside and inside homes, shadowing, phone tapping, infiltrated police were the investigative instruments set up. However, all this has never allowed them to prove the existence of any alleged anarchist terrorist group, which only exists in cops' authoritarian plots. As the prosecutors are not prepared to give up, they have downgraded their ambitions, still counting on making someone pay all the same. So it's on the more malleable charges of criminal association that 12 comrades will be on trial on the 29th of April and in the following days, unquote. This announcement lists the charges against folks and gives titles and blogs, all in French, for people looking to learn more.
Another end of the world is possible from Montreal Counterinfo. Whoever submits things anonymously to Montreal Counterinfo is okay with me. This is an essay on insurgency in Canada, how to do it, whether it's feasible or not, and some good targets for attack. Quote, it may be useful to look closer at how these enemies are thinking about Indigenous insurgency in Canada. Conservative military analyst Douglas Bland has long warned that Canada's economic vulnerability is based on the critical infrastructure that transports natural resources and manufactured goods from mines, oil fields, hydroelectric facilities, and factories to international markets. Without these critical systems, he cautions, Canada's economy would collapse. His writings warn policymakers that the threat of Indigenous insurgency in Canada based on feasibility theory. In counterinsurgency literature, predicting the likelihood of insurgency is shifting from models centered on the motivations of insurgents to a model centered on how feasible an insurgency is in a given context. Grievances that give motivation to insurgency are a constant that can't be redressed in a context of colonial genocide, or capitalism for that matter. Unquote. Food for thought.
Freedom for Lisa, freedom for everyone, from Anonymous. A communique! Gives some background information on Lisa, who is imprisoned for bank robbery. Quote, right now, millions of dissidents are incarcerated who suffer every day under the weight of the prison system and the abuses produced within it. This situation subjects women to a multiple sentence, where in addition to being punished judicially, they are punished on social and moral levels for having disputed their assigned role. At the same time, we're here to question the entirety of the penitentiary, penal, and punishment system that we are immersed in and that we reject. There are too many cases demonstrating that these imposed structures have their reason for being in the defense of economic and political interests that benefit the ruling power, unquote. Translated from Spanish.
Indigenous anarchy and the need for a rejection of the colonizer's civilization. From rattle.me/wiki, an anti-civ and anti-colonial rant that could have come straight from Black and Green. Whether it gets some facts correct, it is a wrap-up of an anarcho-primitivist point of view. Quote, civilized people love to refer to hunter-gatherers as being stricken by poverty, but this poverty is a material poverty, a lack of surplus, luxuries, things. In real terms, hunter-gatherers are far richer than the perpetually in-debt civilized workers who have little room for leisure and must measure their entire existence in terms of time. The civilized, in their agriculture-based societies, must work 5 or 6 days a week simply to survive. The uncivilized have no want of such absurdities. As Marshall Solins noted, hunter-gatherers are the original affluent society. With no material needs, there is no need for poverty or wealth. All people may be equal. A true anarchy! Unquote.
Life Finds a Way, First Manifesto from the Vitalist International, from Commune Magazine by the Vitalist International Atlanta Faction. This is an anarchist, despite the tag. Never mind.
Anathema, Volume 4, Issue 12 released. Poetry, Report Backs, International Analysis, Sabotage, woohoo! What does it mean that I see the tag that says Philadelphia and read pedophile? Ouch. Here are some strengths they mentioned from 2018. Quote, the anarchist space has proved itself to be consistent, communicative, and intense in 2018. Through the major struggles of the year, a range of approaches were put forth. From doxing fascists to knocking on doors to spread information in neighborhoods, from sabotage and attack to squatting and occupation. The methods used have been much more varied than in 2017. Unquote. Ah, those kinds of anarchists.
Fire Ant, Anarchist Prisoner Solidarity from bloomingtonabc.noblogs.org/fire-ant. Issue 2 of this aggressively homemade zine is now available. 14 pages of writings by, about, and or for prisoners. This one comes with a quote by Jeremy Hammond on the cover, information about some prisoners who could use some letters, and writings by Michael Kimball and Eric King, among others. Here's the last of the bit by Eric on being in the box. Quote, this lasted 5 days, but I may never forget even a second of it. Putrid, rancid shit polluting the air, captains and lieutenants coming in while I am chained to a bed like a human X in nothing but my underwear, yelling how they would ensure my getting beaten and raped at my next spot. Some have endured this sort of severe isolation and taunting for months and years. My heart aches for them. One positive about it all, when they turn it up, you really see what you're about, what you can handle. Never did I sway or regret any ideas or actions. They can't break me. The BOP have no qualms with their staff threatening, mocking, beating us, but they hate when we fight back. I made a very personal choice to defend my body and my dignity, to not stand limp and be another victim getting fucked up. I paid for it also. My family is paying for it and will continue to pay for it as we wait to see what discipline or actions they take. I've been in SEG now 49 days, had 30 minutes of phone time during the stretch so far. It's not ending anytime soon. This is the price we pay in here for refusing their hate, for demanding our humanity. For me, this fight was worth it. ACAB, no regrets. Unquote. Reading this will inspire you to write an anarchist prisoner today.
Interview with anarchists from Mukti Wadi Ekta Morcha from Black Autonomy Network, which has the tagline, Revolutionary Anarchism, Black Liberation, and Social War in the Salish Sea, and a red, black, and green background for their Circle A. Quote, question, can you give us a rundown on what anarchism looks like in India? What is it like to organize as anarchists there, and what are its relationships to other social movements? In particular, we know there is an ongoing Maoist insurgency, and we are interested in what, if any, tensions exist with that. Answer, the reaction you get in India for being an anarchist organizer depends significantly on who you talk with, the educated classes, the urban middle class, etc., having swallowed the state propaganda quite thoroughly, to be able to survive in India find you crazy or dangerous, while the laboring section empathize with the essence of anarchist values and desires. I should mention, and this should be stressed, that there is no anarchist movement in India. There are scattered anarchists, of sorts, all over India. As far as I know, ours is the only organized small section. We have had no connections with Maoists. We, on principle, are against the Maoist ideas, the violence this movement is based on, and the ugly turn the Naxalbari movement soon took. That being said, it is quite apparent that the state violence in the region is barbaric and criminal, and the drive for resource extraction and tribal displacement and ecological destruction is devastating. And the state uses the blanket of Maoism to discredit and suppress all genuine struggles in the region, the justification being provided by the actual Maoist violence. But now the blanket has broadened to cover all and any mild progressive social action, unquote.
How the Yellow Vest Movement Survived into 2019, from CrimeThink. Their classic encapsulation wrap-up style article, The Pics of Yellow Vests Dancing While Kettled, is charming. This extensive coverage is broken up by city as, like with Occupy, there are really different scenes in the varying locales.
Whatever Happened to the Church of Anarchy, from mainstream news site Isthmus.com by Andy Moore. This is a retrospective on someone who is safely aged, so it's okay to talk about his past exploits. Quote, Madison old-timers will remember Andy as the prankster-in-chief of the Church of Anarchy, a whirlpool of visual art and performance that swirled from a house on the 1300 block of Williamson Street in the 1980s. Andy created the alternative universe with his late wife, then known as Liz Was. The Iran-Contra affair had protesters in motion on the Capitol Square, but Andy wanted to protest art or, as he puts it, the concept of what art is or what music is or what culture should be made of. During the 1980s and early 1990s, Andy and Was turned art inside out. Performing hundreds of planned and spontaneous performance art shows, their status alternated between counterculture heroes and celebrated mainstream weirdos. For the couple, art was a totem to be torn down and stomped on, even if you had to make art to do it, unquote. This is a fairly respectful look at Andy's life, given that it's a look at the oddities in the rearview mirror.
Audio and video. Radical Anarchists in the BUR 2018, from a2day.net. This 15-minute video with English text is about anarchist actions and repression in Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia, hence BUR. As with any information out of countries under Russian influence, even more than other states, one is left with the conundrum. Is this propaganda to show BUR anarchists as being organized and dangerous because they actually are, or because the state wants people to think that they are to justify torturing them and spending lots of money? The Russian state is the known master of disinformation and fully capable of this kind of mindfuck. That said, I do believe that there are people being tortured there, even if the information getting out serves the purpose of the state demonstrating its own power, among other things, and that they deserve our support, for what that's worth. And we can always hope that BUR anarchists are fully as badass as they're portrayed here. The last half of the video goes more into protests, the economy, and small thumbnails of the greater context.
Anarchy Radio, January 8th, 2019. Always an hour. So, I was set to give kudos to Jay-Z this week because Rotten's call seems to have convinced him to stop talking quite as much shit about other anarchists. However, there was a 13-minute call from a listener who spent most of that time talking himself, which is fine. He had a few interesting things to say and brought up a controversy about anti-Semitism, which was outside the normal Jay-Z box. But this just draws the line so hard on Jay-Z being full of shit when he cuts people off because they're quote-unquote taking too long. The reality is that Jay-Z wants people to call who agree with him and who say nice things to him. And bonus if you call yourself a person of color, no doubt. Other than that, Kath and co-hosts for the usual Bad News, Good News digest. She tries to give shit to anarchist nitpickers, lol, and it was left to another caller to bring in any anarchist analysis of anti-Semitism at all, as nascent as it was.
Announcing season 2 of Rebel Steps. This is 2 minutes of an announcement asking for people to weigh in on what they should talk about in season 2, and to say that they have been included in the warm, left-handed embrace of Channel Zero Network. I haven't personally listened to this podcast before, so all I have to go on is the topics they mentioned for next season, which sound potentially interesting, and their logo, which is red and black flags. Sad face. Could be worth listening to, at least sometimes. Anyone have a favorite episode to recommend?
The brilliant episode 91, Bellamy on Corrosive Consciousness, an hour and 5 minutes. Okay, people might know I really like The Brilliant, in concept, if not always in every specific episode. But even aside from that, the episodes with Bellamy are so good. Each has their own perspectives, sometimes really different, but not hostile. Bellamy helps clarify when A gets obtuse, and A brings the spice in his own kind of clarity. This particular episode is on anarcho-primitivism, specifically telling the detailed backstory of one green anarchist's frustration with Jay-Z, and then moving on to how to deal with the level of conversation that is common in the internet era. Also, practice as a solution to quote-unquote purity spirals. Term of the week.
Error 451, number 14. Leap Encryption Access Project on VPNs and Pseudonymity. 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 From Final Straw Radio. 44 minutes of tech talk. LEAP, or LEAP, is a project to make it easier to use encryption. As someone who still hasn't figured out how to use PGP, that is probably a good thing. The comments bring up an interesting question about who is funding encryption projects. This is not brought up during the episode. The right to be forgotten. New term of the week.
Topic of the week. What are your anarchist goals for 2019? Anarchists are not one to set goals. No gods, no masters. No way to get there. Am I right? But what if we did? Would it look like trying to populate New Hampshire, like the libertarians have tried? Or would it look like invading by numbers a more mainstream group, like the NRA, AA, or whatever, influencing a different direction and or set of priorities? Should our goal look like a big street party or a TAS? Our projects have mostly been media projects, telling the people about our great ideas, but what if instead we start to build little things on our own? Let's not be embarrassed to be old school. A food co-op? A teaching co-op sure would help out some of our friends, young and old. How about we start buying land together? What are your anarchist goals for 2019? How do they differ from 2018?
Well, I guess the simple answer for me in terms of what my anarchist goals are for 2019 is that I really want to try to break up the, the internet entertainment complex. And so the way in which anarchism the past couple of years, you know, has on the one hand been much more activist than it has been before. And, you know, really thinking through, you know, why is that the case? What are the pros and cons to it? Are there any pros at all from my perspective as someone who's hostile to activist thinking? And then, you know, specifically the way in which people have used the internet as you know, there's a thousand ways in which we've talked about this in the past, but, you know, fundamentally the idea is that the internet allows dumb ideas to be magnified really, really fast. And how do we cope with that? How do we deal with that? How do we think about smart ideas? So, you know, in that vein, my personal goal for the year is to try to do this experiment of doing a call-in show that is basically, just trying to solve this problem of, like, how has the internet been a good, a force for evil and a force for good, and how can we make it a more interesting and complicated place to do things?
Well, in terms of goals, and particularly specifically about taking over or occupation, I want to restate my idea of anarchists taking over Delaware. Okay, so there's a military base there, but outside of that, no one cares about Delaware. I'm not even entirely sure it exists in the real world. No one can name three things about Delaware. So it seems like a perfect place for the anarchists to go and everyone would leave them alone. I'm just going to put that out there, which I've been putting this out here for 10 years. But anyway, in a different vein, I guess for me personally, my focus for this year is, I didn't say it, I'm Ariel, and my primary function in the project is that I run the print shop.
This is in the project called Little Black Cart, which is a publishing project that the two of us are involved in.
And one of the things that's complicated about the print shop is that our help rotates. And so lots of training has to happen. And so one of the things that I'm doing this year is focusing on creating a set of written documentation to help kind of create lists and checklists and examples of how work is done in the print shop and how the workflow happens to go with the, you know, I have kind of a pattern. So I can tell you how to do things. And most things in here are actually involved and hands-on. And so I can show you how to do things. But people all learn differently and nothing is actually written down. And so I am trying to figure out how to write things down so that people who aren't me can understand how to do things better. And some of it is based on, like, there's a whole set of things that seem really simple to me, but are common mistakes that almost everyone who gets trained makes. And so how can I help prevent those kinds of common mistakes? And yeah, just trying to, and you know, we forget things and checklists help us not forget things. And yeah, everyone is different and trying to figure out how to make the process work better for all the different people. So I've been thinking about it, that a lot. I've been talking about that a lot. I know someone who has a degree in technical writing, which is rare in our world. And they're going to help me with the project. So that's kind of, it's in my head. That's where my head really is focused this year.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about that particular project, you know, off every anarchist project that has ever been has a role that kind of looks like a behind the curtain role or a role that's unacknowledged, and that role is normally filled by a woman.
Sure.
And so this is actually an example of like an opportunity to talk about how does one challenge that paradigm of like, you know, men are the big men, they're the talkers, they're the ones in front of the stage. Mm-hmm. And the other parts of the project are sort of like invisible gnomes, little brownies do it. Would you have your role be more public?
Well, it is something we've talked about in the past. Mm-hmm. It is, part of what's hard about that transition for me is because part of that means having a more engaged relationship with social media mm-hmm. that I'm actually not interested in having. And I'm not good at it. I'm just not good at it. It is very, very hard for me to care about what happens on Facebook. Sure. And I find Twitter to be an overwhelming shitstorm. Yeah. But in terms of like me being a person involved in the project, I mean, that was part of why I started doing the topic of the week for you was to be a more public face. And it is, while it is deeply insulting that so much of the internet absolutely insists that Little Black Cart is Aragorn and Aragorn is Little Black Cart, when a large percentage of the people behind the scenes are women.
Sure.
At the same time, none of us want to be the public. Like, it's not just you being a public face. The way that you put yourself out there it's exhausting. Yeah. I don't particularly want to engage in it. And the truth is that the shit that you eat, you frequently do with a lot of grace. And I would not, because I think people are just whiny chicken shit mouth runners. And those are the buttons that would be pushed for me and where I would come from, which of course, that is also not dialogue.
Sure.
And not useful. So I'm either going to not take it seriously at all, or I'm going to take it seriously on this whole level that actually isn't relevant.
Yeah.
But I have considered how I can engage with the project in a more public way, but it probably doesn't look like a real time back and forth.
Mm. I mean, I've been disappointed with this segment because it hasn't actually drawn more people out to sort of address you or to interact with you. In other words, this should have been more of an opportunity for you to be a public figure.
Right.
And
no, either I mean, everyone's
the way in which 3/4 of the anarchist space are, you know, softly boycotting anarchist news and as a consequence of this podcast is very frustrating, especially in this regard.
Yeah. Every once in a while I get a atta girl pat on the back. And I've been insulted 2 or 3 times in incredibly boring, uncreative, dumb ways that mostly I just find disappointing.
By anonymous commenters.
Yeah, totally anonymous commenters. Mm-hmm. And they have a thing to say. Somebody had something to say about the way that I talk and my accent, which, you know, like you're the first person ever in my life to tell me that I talk like a white person. Congratulations. Just dumb, you know, it's almost like if you're going to bother to talk shit and troll me, like, be better, basically. And it isn't that. That doesn't seem to be the relationship that people want to have with me through the podcast, which I don't think I had any expectations. So I guess that's okay.
Sure.
But it's also probably, as also has been said, really easy for people to see my presence here as an attachment to you and not my own presence.
Sure.
And I don't know that there's anything that I could actually do about that.
Well,
in this forum.
Yeah. I mean, you could introduce yourself publicly, which, you know, may or may not feel natural to you. I mean, really, this has to do with like... how does someone express their feminism and in a way that's different than many of the expressions of feminism, which sort of seem weak or like, you all should be better. Fix it. You fix it.
I'm a fan of you all should be better.
Sure.
But there's a limit to that.
Yeah.
Yes. I actually just had a discussion with someone else about... doing something that is a slightly more public introduction of myself. So it is in my head. I'm not averse to it. I just have to feel like I understand better what it means for me. And a lot of that's because, you know, when I get the shitty public reaction, I want to feel grounded to either be able to ignore it or to respond to it, you know, deftly or be clever or, you know, something other than, well, you're a whiny, sucky, anonymous crybaby.
Sure. It is worth mentioning that that my book, The Fight for Turtle Island, is coming out in about a week. And
it's very exciting.
So I guess one of my goals for this year is to support that book.
Yeah.
And to make sure it gets into people's hands, into the right people's hands. And, you know, really just that it ends up being as awesome as I hope it is.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Do you have any other goals you want to talk about for this year?
I am actually not really a resolution maker. But I definitely, am putting in place some things for myself personally, changes that I want to make in my life, changes I want to make in not just my daily life, but kind of my overall goals over the next couple of years. Which maybe at some point I'll talk about, but just saying that's kind of new for me. I usually find resolutions to be silly, mostly because they're either things that don't matter or they're huge things that, of course, no one's all of a sudden going to do, you know, just because a day has flipped over on a calendar. But I think I'm treating 2019 a little differently. I'm also going to be 45 this year in a few days, actually, and that's seeming to have some weight on me, but I have no idea why that's a magic number.
Hmm.
Although I do like multiples of 9.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goalkeeper!
Welcome to Redacted. This is going to be the first show of the new year. And with that in mind, we're going to be doing something with somewhat of a different format, as we are going to be exploring a little bit of the background of not only each of the hosts of this segment, but also sort of the background of anarchism as each of us has experienced it within our lifetime, and as each of us has experienced it specifically in 2018. So for this week, I am joined by Squee, and we will be, at least for the time being, skipping some of the questions that have been coming up on the Ask Anarchists hashtag on Twitter and just jumping into a bit of our background. So, Squee, I welcome you to the show, and you know, we'll just sort of jump in here. You know, there's been a lot of conversation with the most recent episodes on the Brilliant podcast with Aragorn, where we've had some conversations about some of the other segments on the Anarchist News podcast. But I think a good place to start is just sort of like who you are and, you know, perhaps where your name came from and how it was that you were introduced to anarchism in a way that it pertains to where things are going today.
All right. Well, that sounds good. I'm glad to be here today. Sipping on my Manhattan, which is the cocktail of the month for me. And let's get down to it. So a lot of people ask me when they meet me where the name Squee comes from, and I have one of several answers. But the real story begins that I grew up in what might be called the MTV generation. And a lot of people I knew were watching Beavis and Butthead. And on Beavis and Butthead, if you've ever seen it, the anarchy symbol is prominently displayed throughout many of the episodes. So it became a common tag or just a rebellious thing to write on your homework or your notes or whatever you were doing. And that primed me for later reading about anarchism when I came about it at a bookstore. And also sort of prepared me for a mentality where punk rock came to me as a given way of interacting in the world. That being said, Squee itself is a character in a comic book, and the comic book
that's right.
is an underground comic book that was, on Slave Labor Graphics. And it is called Johnny the Homicidal Maniac. And Squee was the next door neighbor to Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, who was periodically tormented and had parents that were negligent and all the rest. And he later grew up to be a spinoff character for his own book. Anyway, I had the shirt and for the Squee comic book, and I would wear the shirt most days of the week. And what happened is I started meeting people in the punk scene and in the anarchist community. That became my nickname, which morphed into my stage name and my pen name and my online persona. So this is almost 20 years ago now. Wow. That I've had my life split in two by this name that people I've chosen to meet tend to call me, and then my real life name that probably has less of a footprint in the world than Squee does.
Is that with intention, would you say? Like, do you find yourself kind of trying to fly under the radar outside of the Squee name?
I would say that I was lucky enough to have a functioning persona right around the time when employers began using social media to research applicants. So I already had a way around that and merely took advantage of it. I didn't plan that out from the start. There was never a lot of consideration about using Squee as a way to prevent people from finding out who I really was, because people in real life called me that regularly. So,
and then coming from the background that you did, I mean, so for for folks who are just now coming into this, like when you say that you come from a punk background, I think that that probably means something different today than it did, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And so, you know, maybe you could speak a little bit about what you mean about the sort of like offline world of punk that sort of preceded the social media internet world that, that sort of consumes everything today.
So, right. So my experience with punk is even different than a lot of other anarchists who came into it from a punk background, because I really, the early 2000s and the late 90s would be the period I'm talking about. And at the time, I was mostly interested in a couple subgenres of punk music, which were street punk and oi, which oi is like skinhead music, and street punk is the friendly punk rock to skinhead music, and also bands like Crass that have their longstanding anarchist credentials behind them. There is also at the time a lot of experimental hardcore music coming out of where I lived, but also regions around where I live. And what I mean by that is bands like Page 99 or I don't know what might be called emo if you're of a certain age, but it does not mesh with what is called emo the next 10 years after that. So the as the lifestyle goes, my lifestyle was more in the street punk way of living, where I was drinking 40s in alleys and going to punk shows four or five times a week, and just basically destroying shit when I'd get drunk, and you know, falling asleep in random squats and whatever. It was a very no future, no responsibility way of life. And I did have the internet, and it was an important part of meeting other street punks, because this was the time of like AOL and you know, whatever else like that. But it was the internet of message boards, and it was the internet of listservs, and there wasn't a lot of apprehension of meeting someone online and then going in, hanging out with them in real life at a show or something like that. So the internet tended to facilitate real life interaction, which includes how I found out about the local anarchist community, which in 2000 formed as a group called Phoenix Anarchist Coalition. Mm. And that's when I began going to anarchist meetings. Which what that does, it actually dovetails a little bit into what anarchism looked like from my perspective at that time, which is, you know, coming out of the Seattle anti-globalization Battle of Seattle time period, anarchists tended to create collectives of one kind or another, and they had names, and they tried to do things based on consensus, and a lot of those things were silly, and some of them weren't, but there was a real attempt to act as an organization, even if you weren't a platformist. And this, yeah. So what tended to happen was most of my punk friends would go to one or two meetings and say, fuck that, these people are nerds. And then, but I was a nerd, so I would stick around at the meetings, and I was interested in the literature, and I read a lot, and I really connected with the ideas. So I pursued that more and more as time went on, as my identification with punk fell away, and I became interested in other musical genres and other ways of presenting myself.
And that seems to be like a huge difference, because so much, at least in my experience of coming up on sort of the tail end of a lot of what it is that you're describing right now, you know, leaving punk and remaining within anarchism really was a sort of like a desert. You know, there really wasn't a whole lot of guidance in terms of what it meant to be not punk and still anarchist. So what was that experience like for you?
Well, it was very experimental. I tried to draw from all the other things I was interested in, whether that was glam rock or death rock and goth music or chaos magic or whatever weird other shit that I got into, and bring it into an anarchist framework. And I feel like a lot of other people at the same time were doing that. And I really felt like it was a vibrant anarchist community. I was able to travel out to San Francisco and go to the anarchist book fair out there when it was still in San Francisco. And there was, you know, I felt that if I was going to be a traveler kid, I could kind of pop in whatever state there was and like search the internet a little bit from a library and figure out where the anarchists were, and that would like hook me up. And that was sort of the anarchist environment I was coming into. But as a culture, the signifiers were all over the place. There was academic types, there was clearly crust punks, there was I don't know, there was like the older crew who Aragorn and Lawrence and all those types would fit in that category. So yeah, I don't know. It was there wasn't a lot set in stone. And that I think Hakeem Bey had a big affinity with me for that reason, just because he writes about this sort of like chaotic, plural, carnivalesque kind of thing happening. And I don't know, seemed to me how it was.
And perhaps it was, you know, it seems as though a lot of that stuff has sort of fallen by the wayside. And I'm having trouble remembering the name of this podcast that we were just listening to earlier. It's what, is it Seriously Problematic? Is that the name of it?
Seriously Wrong.
Seriously Wrong. And so one of the things that they were just talking about on this latest episode that they were doing on Snark was they were talking about the paranoia that seems to be sort of punctuating the anarchist scene today. And, you know, just in hearing you reminisce about a lot of this stuff, because, you know, again, I had sort of like one foot in the tail end of the scene and then one foot in what we know of as anarchism in 2018. That paranoia didn't really exist. You know, like I was meeting train hopping friends from Yahoo groups and just saying like, hey, here's who I am. Let's go to this bar and meet up. And it was perfectly normal for that sort of thing to happen, you know, right. or to say, you know, hey, let's meet up at this conference or anything like that. And, you know, in hearing you even talking about Hakeem Bey, like these ideas seem to have been completely swallowed up by this paranoia, where meeting people online as a means of you know, orchestrating something that's going to be happening in person just seems to have completely died off. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
I have so many thoughts about that. It's hard to organize all of them. What has changed in the economy and the way that the material foundation of the internet, the way that people get online with broadband or with their cellular service, the way that video recognition technology or facial recognition technologies are so easily used by agencies or other individuals, the way that a familiarity with HTML and other programming languages used to be more commonplace, and now Facebook and services like Squarespace or whatever other content management system are making that irrelevant. And just the sheer amount of people that are online and are going to find you, whether you think you're avoiding them or not, because of the algorithms, is totally different. I mean, you used to be able to pretty much get online anonymously as far as most people were concerned. You could, you know, if you were like really into hacking, you could use a payphone, or you could like use a, you could use what was called a beige box and hook up to somebody else's phone line, their landline, and dial up to an internet service provider, and you could really be anonymous online in a way that broadband does not make possible. And maybe a burner phone or something, you could do that now, but I just have no idea. And I think a lot of this paranoia comes from the changes of the technology itself, but also the changes of the economy play a huge role in that, I think. And the way that the economy has been changed by Silicon Valley, but also the way that the financial crash and the recovery has affected people's income, the way that social services have been cut and it's harder to live off of the welfare state, and also the way that companies like Amazon have made it harder to eke by in a subculture, selling subcultural artifacts like CDs or records or zines or whatever they may be.
And perhaps, you know, we haven't quite moved away from these sort of like subcultural artifacts so much. Like maybe the commodity that was once physical has become somewhat intellectual. And so the items that we share today aren't necessarily that Ausrotten LP that everyone is clamoring for, but rather...
Right. Or Polloi.
Right. But like, you know, this particular way of thinking that ends up being shared and distributed widely among all of these active subcultures. You know, I kind of wonder if any of that really disappeared, or if it just became more abstract.
Well, I know it hasn't totally disappeared. I still go out and I wind up at punk shows and at the bars I go to. And there's still people that are very enthusiastic about it. But I think what has changed is that it's much harder to grow older in a subculture, and to be able to live that subculture as you get into your 30s and later, where you have to start thinking about things like how you're going to go to the doctor. And I know people who are committed and who have not gotten a mainstream job or don't have any kind of job really. But I think that part of it is becoming more and more rare.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, just, you know, again, returning to this, to the subject of snark, you know, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine here locally not too long ago, and he was describing the sort of online culture of 4chan and how there is this sort of like the rings from inside of a tree, where the language and the references change so rapidly that you can tell a person's belonging and the generation of that person simply based on the language that they're using, the images that they're using for reference, and all these sorts of things. And so the idea of, as you were just mentioning, sort of like growing old in our subcultures, or even having elders within these different cultures, it's kind of unheard of today, because really what we seem to be valuing the most are those who are able to remain on the cutting edge constantly and consistently. And the way that this seems to be shown is this sort of like snarky one-upmanship of those who are basically saying, you know, here I am on the edge, there all of you are outside of it, and sort of just really, you know, if you find yourself away due to health, or if you find yourself away due to age, It appears to be extremely alienating today. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I know there's some writing about what's called present shock and the way that the internet has shifted away from a connection with history, and it's and even really a connection with the future, and it's very much present moment, instantaneous, blah 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 blah. But I don't know. I can't say that I've thought a lot about the sort of in-group belonging that's a result of being close to these hubs of snarky internet culture generation. And I don't know what the motive would be to get closer to that besides maybe some kind of social feelings. But otherwise, I don't know if that could lead to any kind of material gains, for instance, for somebody that's hip to the jive. You know, do people think that they're going to be have more YouTube followers and more advertising on their YouTube if they get closer to that hub? Or, you know, what is behind it that's driving the adherence to that kind of labor? Because it's work. It takes a lot of work to stay on top of that kind of shit. And like you just said, if you're injured or, you know, you have a medical issue, that you know, you lose out on your work. And so I don't know. It's interesting. I don't like it.
Well, it seems as though the cultural value then is just so fragile and fleeting that beyond the superficial, there is very little that exists as things move forward. I mean, if someone has to be cutting edge the entire time and there's nothing but the edge, it doesn't seem as though there's very much to be had there at all.
Well, I mean, what makes this a little more concrete? Like, who can we talk about? I mean, Milo Yiannopoulos would be somebody that is a prime example of cutting edge, hipster, obviously right-wing piece of shit, but somebody who has maintained a cultural affinity with this snarky kind of thing. And I mean, as far, you know, from a perspective of how do you make money doing that or something like that, I mean, clearly Breitbart, you know, like, needed him to connect to an audience. And I think that there is something about media culture and stuff like that driving this. And it's not just organic. And there's a history of it too, which goes, it actually predates the internet with stuff like Cool Hunting. And there's this guy, Douglas Rushkoff, who has a documentary called The Men, Merchants of Cool, where mm-hmm. he talks all about how, you know, MTV and these other, and Viacom and AOL Time Warner and these other conglomerates were specifically interested in capitalizing on the teen market. So what they would do is they would send out agents to find early adopters of different youth subcultures so that they could better market, gain their trust, and sell products to them. And I think that something similar is probably happening, where you have people like Milo Yiannopoulos and you have Breitbart as a profitable media conglomerate in one way or another. And there's a relationship there that's reproducing a culture that that's recreating the quote-unquote cool person who is going to be trusted and be able to sell products, or ideologies in their case.
Well, in our case too, it would seem.
Right.
You know, in all of the language that you were just using, all of this rings true to sort of this, you know, 2018 anarchism, where you have these sort of torch carriers who, by means of attention, have been gifted the influence over everyone else to essentially say what is the cool, what is the not, and claim this throne of influence that appears really to be gifted by no other means than just right place, right time, and right resources. You know, which I guess kind of like leads me into this next question, which is just sort of like anarchism as we experience it in 2018, going into 2019, especially in comparison to what we were experiencing in the 90s and the early 2000s, is one that is really punctuated by the sort of like cyber culture that seems to just permeate through all different forms of life today. And so in terms of what it is that you were just describing, you know, in what ways do you think that influences anarchism as we know it now?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is how far behind anarchists are when it comes to this. The people that are really ahead of this game are the Libertarian Party types. And we know that. We have seen that through things like 4chan or through just like how many Rothbardian and Von Mises Institute fucking people there are out there. That, and what it is that they've aligned themselves with technocracy in a way, right? So one thing that comes to mind is the Zeitgeist movement, which I don't know. Are you familiar with that at all?
I am. And I'm trying to even think that. So that would have been, let's see, later than 2005. So that would have been maybe 2006, 2007.
But it was definitely within like the time frame where it mattered if you believed 9/11 was caused by what the government said it was or not, right? You know, if you were a truther, right? And the first Zeitgeist, you know, film that came out was about like three things, which are basically were like, okay, Christianity is stupid because look at all this mythology that was in the region at the time. It's the same stuff. The other thing was like, you know, it's sort of like an eco-socialist utopian project that was, you know, talking about the profit motive. And then I forget what the third, and the other thing was 9/11 and talking about, you know, sort of like the conspiratorial, not truther kind of shit. And it became popular enough that they were able to eventually leverage that popularity into what was called the Zeitgeist movement. Well, the Zeitgeist movement itself was formulated as quote unquote the activist wing of the Venus Project. And the Venus Project was, I forget the guy's name who ran it, Jacques something.
Yeah, Jacques Fresco.
Right. So that was like an early iteration of what I think is happening now with meme culture and the way that political ideology is trying to function in this new kind of media landscape. I don't know if there's anyone who's made that connection, but I think the popularity of the Zeitgeist movement probably gave some people ideas, or at least is a good example of the reason why libertarians in particular are closer to these new forms of cultural reproduction because of their willingness to embrace the technology that's behind it. As a Bitcoin is a prime example, right? So I think anarchists are lagging behind a lot of that. And even anarchists who are technologically sophisticated, like Moxie, Marlin Spike, they're not the people who anyone's interviewing about anarchism. So there's not really this like this connection between the technologically sophisticated and the culturally productive. And I think where you see that connection is where you're getting the reproduction of anarchism today. For example, you know, it's going down. Are people who are technologically sophisticated enough to put together the website, create the media, and also they're culturally sophisticated enough to produce the content. And so I think that's sort of the dynamic of anarchist media production today.
Sort of those with the means are those that sort of dictate what ends up being influential.
Yeah, but it's means, and it's also like a willingness to embrace the new technological landscape. And I think a lot of forms of anarchism are inherently, if not incidentally, opposed to embracing that.
Well, I think that's a big part of it. And I should say, too, that we've got about, it looks like, 10 minutes left. It looks as though what it kind of comes down to is what fits into the world as we know it today versus what simply cannot fit into the world as we know it today. You know, to like as you've been talking about, if you end up taking this sort of cybernetic approach, well, of course that fits, because that sort of fits into the timeline that's unfolding as we already know it. You know, this is sort of like possibility aspect of all of this stuff. For anarchist thought that challenges this status quo, this mainstream way of thinking, it doesn't fit so nicely into the way that things are unfolding today. And so it also has a difficult time translating to the sort of like, stream of being shared, being influential, and being absorbed by the kinds of people who so far have been sort of gatekeepers of this knowledge and of the sort of allocating of permission, that it's okay if you think a certain way or if you hold a certain position. And until you've, you know, mentioned a lot of this stuff, I hadn't really thought about it in these terms, but it creates a challenge for where anarchism is going to be, not only in 2019, but moving forward, which is sort of like almost embracing a sort of mainstream irrelevance. And what are your thoughts on that? You know, what does it mean to step outside of this technocracy, outside of this cybernetic populism, and to begin exploring something that people might relate to as being deeply personal, as opposed to viral.
Well, you kind of threw in a second part to that when I was thinking of an answer to the first part.
But, well, let's begin with the first then.
Okay. So I think the anarchists that are working on projects that are maybe connected to the internet, maybe not, but are focused on moving towards activity in either in nature, you know, to use that word, but we all know what it means, or at least at a in their neighborhoods, I think are really on the cutting edge of what could be practical about anarchism moving forward. There's a lot of like hacktivist kind of stuff that's been written about or thought about, which I honestly don't think it's very effective. And you know, like swarm, whatever, blackout days, or just whatever the fuck it is. None of it, short of blowing up a data center, seems very effective to me. So in that regard, yeah, I think that that moving away from the cybernetic, or at least taking the cybernetic and pointing it away from itself, is going to become more and more important. And I envision that as sort of a cyberpunk project, but maybe that's the wrong word to use because it implies sort of a technophilic orientation towards the cybernetic. But as far as the personal goes, I mean, I think anarchism is still very personal. I don't know how much that's disappeared. I think there's still a lot of personal connection and, you know, inter and intrapersonal stuff that people try to work out through adopting an anarchist framework.
And with our last, roughly, it looks like 2 minutes, I would actually argue that it seems as though we have lost the person, that we have sacrificed it for this sort of social filtering that happens online where people collaborate on what script is appropriate for anarchists to be regurgitating on a regular basis. And if they step outside of that, they are punished for their lack of obedience. As a sort of union scab. I kind of wonder what that leads to, because, you know, there isn't a lot of reflection on where exactly it is that the winning thoughts, or rather these influences, are coming from. And so when I talk about something being personal, I'm also kind of talking about, like in the brilliant episode 89, about being authentic. And it seems as though we've lost our sense of authenticity. And so it appears our last 30 seconds. Well, okay. What are your thoughts on on that? On, can we bring authenticity back, and has it been lost?
Yes, it can be brought back, but I can't talk about that in 20 seconds.
The podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Chisel. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, see you at anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room linked on ANews.